he can make us a carrot stick.
We're tobacco.
No, we are not tobacco. We are Robert Downey Jr. He was so high, he was crawling into people's windows. Now he's Iron Man.
Okay, welcome to a brand new podcast on the Real World Network. That's right, it's a network. We have so many podcasts now. In theory, there will be three when you're listening to this. We're recording it way in advance, but it should be the first week of January. And there's a very good reason for that. But before I explain that, I will be one host of this. My name is Matt Waters. You can hear me on pretty much every Real World podcast that exists. And I will be joined not by Mike Thomas, but my good compatriot, Ben Phillips, co-host of Pitch Please, and he talked about the Emmys once. Ben, how are you this evening?
I am good, thank you. How are you?
I'm good. You know what? Mike never asks me that, so I'm already enjoying this more.
It's that ingrained British politeness that...
Exactly. We're so John Oliver. Right, so let's just cut to the chase there. Way back when me and Mike were doing X-Men podcasts, Mike and Matt's Excellent Adventures, you can find that on YouTube and SoundCloud and EntertheRealWorld.com, and when we were doing Batman, we actually got a lot of requests from strangers on the internet, to do the Marvel films, and Mike was always a little bit resistant. He preferred doing them as articles, our little, you know, eight questions about whatever. I don't know if it was just, like, the task of going all the way back through them or whatever, but for better or worse, Ben and I have decided to take up the challenge. And why is it important that this is going to be the first week in January? It's because I sat down and worked out how many weeks until Avengers Infinity War. And it turns out, if my maths is right, there will be one episode per entry in the MCU. And it will culminate in the 10-year anniversary of the MCU. And the 10-year anniversary of the release of the film we're going to be talking about first, which is Iron Man, released May 2nd. 2008. So hasn't that all worked out well? I would have liked to have done Marvel Mondays, but Ben pointed out the anniversary will fall on a Wednesday. So welcome everyone to Ben and Matt's Marvelous Journey. I don't know, that's a work in progress, that title. We'll see. That should be a cool logo and stuff by the time you hear this.
You've got enough time to work on a design.
I do. I say me, I don't make them. Thank you, Saskia Parks, for making all of our logos. So, Iron Man is the first entry in the MCU. But before we can even talk about that, like, there was no MCU back before 2008. Like, it was a very different world. There weren't 800 superhero movies a year. Matt was a lot sadder than he is now because there weren't 800 superhero movies a year.
Close to that point. I was sad in 2008 because the last 2 years had had some pretty terrible superhero movies.
That's true. And that's pretty relevant because... I mean, okay, right. Because it's the first episode, we're going to do a little history lesson here. So while Marvel now may seem like an invincible, unstoppable media conglomerate, they were actually bankrupt in the 90s and got bought by a toy company, Toy Biz, I think they were called. Avi Arad and Ike Perlmutter, both of whom seem like complete assholes, bought Marvel. And they actually, to their credit, sort of got them out of bankruptcy by selling film rights to every studio walking. So that's why you got Spider-Man and X-Men and Hulk and Fantastic Four and Blade and Daredevil and Elektra and Punisher and Ghost Rider.
You're just reading a list now.
Ben, I have notes, okay? It's a very it's a very professional setup. Most of those films mentioned are not all that good. Some of them are decent. But most importantly, Marvel actually, despite this rescuing them from bankruptcy, weren't making a huge amount per movie. And there were people within Marvel who were like, well, we'd make more if we made our own movies, because then you control the characters and you have a larger profit share. So, Avi Arad's second-in-command, a man by the name of Kevin Feige, who at the time no one had heard of, who is a great big Marvel fanboy, he came up with this concept of... Well, I believe he's credited with coming up with the idea of a shared film universe, which had not really been done before, with characters crossing over into each other's films and building up to team-ups and, you know, all this kind of stuff. And he pitched this idea. They went and got a $525 million loan from Merrill Lynch. That's a significant amount of money. And Arad resigned because he didn't think this would work, I guess. He still gets some producer credits, and I think he works on Spider-Man. But fuck that dude, fuck Ike Perlmutter as well. So Marvel build this little six-man team that actually have a working knowledge of Marvel Comics, something that maybe Warner Brothers and Fox could learn from. And they set about creating this shared universe. And I don't think it quite works the same way since Disney bought them out. I think it's now a three-man team. But never mind. Paramount initially helped them distribute these films, but Disney, as I said, bought Marvel at some point, so they took all that over. And they decided, while they didn't have the licenses to the various films I mentioned before, Kevin Feige noticed, we do have the rights to all of the principal members of the Avengers. So why don't we do that? And they decided to kick off with Iron Man, which is a potentially controversial choice, as Ben will cover in a minute. But there had been talks of Iron Man films throughout the 90s. Nicolas Cage and Tom Cruise had expressed interest in playing him. Joss Whedon was at one point working on one. David Hayter, famously writer of X-Men 1 and voice actor for Solid Snake from Metal Gear Solid, they all, you know, had a go at an Iron Man film. I think Quentin Tarantino was involved at one point. And 30 different writers passed on writing Iron Man because they just didn't have faith that this Marvel Studios thing would work out. They didn't have faith that the Iron Man character would be, you know, mainstream enough. We take it for granted now that Marvel exists, but not many film studios just start up, you know? Like, I believe the last major one before Marvel Studios was, like, DreamWorks, and that was a long time ago, so they were attempting a very ambitious thing. It's like a whole Harry Potter thing of, like, oh, how could all these publishers pass on Harry Potter? Well, Ben, why don't you talk a little bit about Iron Man? Because we now think of him as, like, A-list, sort of co-leader of the Avengers, the biggest star in the MCU, but growing up, I watched the Iron Man cartoon, but beyond that, there wasn't a huge amount of Iron Man out there in the world. Now, you, as I've said before, trump me when it comes to comic book knowledge, so we're going to defer to you in these episodes to sort of give us a rundown of your kind of history with the character and just sort of some thoughts on them before this movie and what the movie did for them. So why don't you kick us off with some Iron Man talk?
Oh, God, Iron Man is such a weird character, because obviously, like, in the, he was created in the early days of the Marvel Universe, so you go back to the early 1960s when Stan Lee and Jack Kirby were basically churning out new characters every single month. But even in the kind of hierarchy of those 1960s characters, I doubt you'd even put Iron Man in the top 10 of the ones that they created back then, because it's basically, they made, I mean, like, of the ones that people know about, Spider-Man is the only one that Jack Kirby didn't co-create.
Yeah.
But then, but if you go for what Stan Lee created in the 60s, it's, but you've got Fantastic Four, you've got the X-Men, who at this point were bigger, not because of Stan Lee, but because of just the X-Men's proliferation throughout all media by the early 90s.
Mm-hmm.
And 2000s, the X-Men were huge. Spider-Man is obviously huge. Captain America was, after Superman, probably the biggest patriotic symbol that you had going for you, created in very similar circumstances as Superman by Jewish creators doing something to kind of fight back against the war going over in going war in Europe. And then Iron Man was just this kind of weird character that Stan Lee created because he wanted to do something Cold War-y and have a go at communists.
Yep. By fighting the Mandarin.
Yeah, so, I mean, Iron Man is just weird. I mean, most of the interesting Iron Man stories were not done by Stan Lee or Jack Kirby. They were done years later, and they kind of deal with real-life psychological problems. I mean, like, the most iconic Iron Man story of all time is Demon in a Bottle, which is Tony Stark as alcoholic. And it's one of those things that Marvel Comics did really well, was our characters have real flaws. Something we'll touch on probably quite a bit more in the Ant-Man episode. So Tony Stark is an alcoholic, and also Tony Stark makes technology that gets into other people's hands are probably the only two pieces of mainstream knowledge that I was aware of, really, in any single way. Like, I knew he had a best friend who was also in a suit.
A much cooler looking suit from my childhood. It's got missiles and shit.
Yeah. But, like, Iron Man's one of the characters who, he has two stories that are iconic and probably, like, rise above the rest of them, but for the most part, he's thoroughly B-list.
Yeah. This film happens, and suddenly they draw Tony Stark to look like Robert Downey Jr., and suddenly there are a million Iron Man stories, and you know, extremists and all
well,
this.
Extremists was before.
Was it before? Oh, my bad. Yeah, so this is why you're here.
Extremists was before, because this was the Extremists was where they basically pulled every single design thing they had for Iron Man was from Extremists, and Audie Greinoff's redesign of the character. So I can't remember when it was. I think it was 2006. Yeah, it was a few years before this came out, or before this came out. Yeah, 2005, 2006 it came.
Fair enough. Well, we will mention Extremis again in a few episodes' time.
So we will. Extremis will come up. But yeah, like, Extremis is probably the biggest touchstone for this as a design piece, if we're going for that. Because if you look at the old Iron Man suits, they're very much like...
They look like fabric. Like, he looks like he's wearing the classic, like, tights underpants type thing.
Yeah, and like, you, I mean, some of the costumes are just weird. You've got this whole thing where, like, if you watch the 90s animated show, you'll know that Tony Stark's got a whole mess of suits. Like, I'm going underwater now, I need the underwater suit, and then it's just a suit.
I need the stealth armor, I need the space armor.
And obviously, like, these movies do eventually get into different armors and stuff like that, but it's kind of like that. This is getting into Iron Man 3 territory, but they do a very interesting thing where it's more of his psychological state of mind behind why he's making all these suits, as opposed to he needs all these suits because this one suit doesn't do everything it can possibly need to do.
Yes.
But yeah, so as we're heading into this movie, Iron Man was probably the biggest B-list character that Marvel had.
Yeah.
Like Hulk, Thor, and Captain America all have more mainstream showings, just based on the fact that, like, there was the Hulk TV series that with the live action one. Captain America, as I said, was this great patriotic,
and like so many Captain America films that are very shoddy but had still been made over the years.
Exactly.
And I think he was in the Spider-Man cartoon in like a little mini arc, and
yes, and then Thor is obviously, I mean, like,
Thor is he was Thor.
In he was in he's Thor, but he was also in the Hulk TV series. There is a movie which is explicitly called Hulk versus Thor, or
it's called Thor Ragnarok.
But yeah, so Iron Man is a weird choice. Like, he is the founding member of one of the founding members of the Avengers, but
so was Ant-Man.
So was Ant-Man, and Ant-Man doesn't get a show up in the movie in the first Avengers movie.
No, but while this movie is being made, Edgar Wright is somewhere in the world tinkering on his Ant-Man story, which unfortunately will never exist.
Yeah, it's an interesting choice, because I think there is love for the Iron Man character. I think there are people in the world who are like, I really loved reading Iron Man comics when they were kids. They're the people that weren't reading X-Men. It's what X-Men, like, they weren't Spider-Man or X-Men kids, therefore they got left with Iron Man, I guess.
Well, do you know who was an Iron Man fan growing up? It was Robert Downey Jr., who was cast in 2008's Iron Man. So yeah, this was their first go at bat. They hired Jon Favreau, who had made Elf. And Zathura. Zathura allegedly got in the job because Avi Arad's kids, or like his kid's friend, I don't know, someone was raving about Zathura.
Zathura is fun. I enjoyed Zathura when I saw it in the cinema.
I hear it's very good, but you know, if you look at this dude's filmography pre-Iron Man, like, obviously Elf is, I feel Elf has like become a phenomenon over time. I mean, I'm sure it was very successful when it came out, but I feel it's suddenly become this like amazing of a generation classic. Anyway, they hire Jon Favreau. They give it a budget of $140 million, which, I mean, that is a significant amount of money, but budgets have ballooned over time, and also they got some very expensive actors to be in this thing. So it's not modest, but it's not as high as it might be. And it did make over $585 million.
I mean, this was a launching point for the franchise, and it was also before foreign markets were kind of as important as they are now.
Mm-hmm. Nowadays, a Marvel film opens and it's probably going to make that region, whether it's good, bad, how famous the character is, whatever. This is from nothing. A hero that most people don't know about, a main star who is on his second comeback from a lot of legal problems, who, for however good an actor he had been, for how many things he had been in, had never been in a huge, huge blockbuster project. And this changed that.
And but it's also someone that Marvel actively didn't want to be in the movie. Like, Jon Favreau
had to fight for him, yeah. I think it's like written into his contract, it probably isn't anymore, but for a long time it was, he couldn't have his full amount of money until he'd finished filming, because he just not turned up to so many things during his...
That has definitely not been the case now, considering he's got, what, the 1% of the box office gross in his contract now, whatever it is.
And like, I think he gets a flat $50 million fee for every appearance as Tony Stark. So, not doing badly now, Mr. Downey Jr.
No. Although, the interesting part of that is that in this first Iron Man film, there was another actor who was better paid than he was.
Ah.
Do you know? Can you? Okay, which of the main actors do you think was better paid than Downey Jr. was for this one?
Jeff Bridges?
No.
Gwyneth Paltrow?
No.
Terrence Howard?
Terrence Howard made more money for this movie than Robert Downey Jr. did.
The maths of his pay just probably didn't add up. Right, so, what's it about? So, Tony Stark is a genius, billionaire, playboy, but most importantly, not yet a philanthropist. He is the head of Stark Industries, who design and sell weapons. During a demonstration of his latest one in Afghanistan, he is captured by a terrorist group called the Ten Rings, which is a not-so-subtle nod to Iron Man's classic nemesis, the Mandarin, who is very hard to film, but we'll get to that. He's coerced into building his new missile for them, but he instead secretly builds a suit of armor in this cave with bare minimal resources, and he fights his way out and escapes. When he returns to America, he announces that they're not only going to sell weapons because he's seen firsthand what they do to people. The company takes a huge hit. His business partner, Obadiah Stane, is not best pleased. But Tony doesn't give a damn. He starts working on a better version of his suit in his lab. It is delightful. And he builds the Iron Man armor. He also perfects the arc reactor technology that powers it and also keeps him alive because he's got some shrapnel on his chest, which is different amounts of important as we go through. But hey, he finds out that his weapons are still being sold to terrorists, no less. And so he flies all the way to the Middle East, destroys them, kills the people using them, decides he wants to be a nice, good person. Meanwhile, Stane is revealed to have been the guy who paid the Ten Rings to try and kill him, and he wants to take control of the company. He reverse engineers a version of the Iron Man suit using his prototype he made in Afghanistan, and he steals Tony's arc reactor and almost kills him to do it. But hey, they have a big fight. It's a bit underwhelming. Tony has Pepper Potts overload the giant arc reactor that powers the factory, and that kills Stane. And then the film ends with a press conference wherein Tony is instructed by the government organization SHIELD to deny his involvement in these events, but he very famously admits, "I am Iron Man," and then we get credits, and then we get the first of a never-ending cascade of post-credit scenes wherein Samuel L. Jackson turns up as Nick Fury and starts telling him about the Avengers, and movie history has changed forever. It's a very simple story, and I think that is tremendously to its benefit. It's not a huge, huge cast. I mean, obviously, there's a lot of people in it, but in terms of, like, characters that matter, we're talking, like, five or six here. And four of them are, like, huge. Well, Terrence Howard isn't, like, a star, but, you know, he's a very good actor, very solid. You got three huge stars and Terrence Howard, who's very, very solid. And, yeah, it just works as a starting point. And I think they made three huge decisions with this movie, and the first and most important one that would affect all of the MCU going forward is casting Robert Downey Jr. as Tony Stark. And as we talk about this cast, and just the movie generally, I think it begins and ends with casting Robert Downey Jr. as Tony Stark, because he absolutely fucking crushes it from the first scene. He is so, so charming. He's, like, such a cocky prick, but he's, like, demonstrably brilliant and funny, that it makes you root for him. Like, people like brilliant assholes. Well, phrasing. And, you know, even in his most sort of morally grey areas, he still has always had this kind of moral code where he just kind of, he's just a bit different the way he goes about it. We'll see it as he interacts with more morally upright characters going forward. But I just, Robert Downey Jr. is Tony Stark. There's a reason they started drawing him to look like Robert Downey Jr. in the comics. He influenced everything, and he made himself Hollywood's, like, biggest star on and off since then, and commands a huge salary, but I think it's been worth it in spades for Marvel, because, I mean, holy hell, they took chicken something else and made chicken salad with it. So, RDJ.
You've kind of nailed it. It's like, I don't think there is a better piece of casting for a character in any of these MCU movies.
No.
From the ground up, I do not think you get better than him. And you can argue whether or not, like, it's just he was the right actor at the right time and he managed to change a role into fitting him.
Mm-hmm.
But when you hear what the production of this movie was like, based on the fact that, like, they got the plot of the movie down, and they kind of, like, got what they wanted to happen get down. But there was no dialogue.
Nope.
So every single scene of dialogue is improvised, pretty much.
Yeah.
Like, all was written on the fly on the set. And the fact that there's still such a huge amount of charisma that comes through on the screen just says what a talent, what a force they had. Yeah. In this role, and it shows on screen. Like, I don't think, like, that you can quibble about so much about this movie in terms of its pacing, in terms of its plot, in terms of, like, its overall meaning, but at the end of it you just kind of come away saying, like, but Robert Downey Jr. is having the time of his life, and I'm having the time of my life watching him do this.
It's an absolute tour de force by him. As you said, like, you know, heavy amount of improv, like, he would try different things in every take, like the whole thing of him sitting on the floor during the press conference is all him, and like little moments like that, you don't see a lot of that in films, like these little idiosyncrasies. Just so good. And I don't think it can be understated how good he looks on these fake magazine covers, and just how, like, believably famous he is in a way that some actors just can't pull off. Like, Christian Bale obviously is famous, but he doesn't look famous, you know? Like, Robert Downey Jr. in Iron Man, in those suits, he just looks like a wealthy, famous, like, playboy dude. And it works. Like, if they'd cast someone who, you know, was a good actor but just couldn't pull off that side of it, like, I just don't see that working. But there's just so much fun to be had, and I think we actually see it more going forward, just seeing him be rich in public, you know.
I mean, you hear the kind of people they were looking at before this, and, like, you get the near ubiquitous rumor that Nicolas Cage was going to play Tony Stark, and it's like, all right, you can't be Superman and Tony Stark.
You can be the Human Torch and Captain America, but you can't be Superman and Iron Man.
I mean, those two are too fundamentally different. Superman is supposed to be a bastion of, like, all that's great about America, and Iron Man is somewhat more flawed than that, and I don't think Nicolas Cage embodies either of those two ideals.
And, like, you know, you talk about him being flawed, and, like, Jon Favreau's made no bones about that's, like, part of why he casted him, that Robert Downey Jr. has obviously had very public problems and has come through them largely because of this movie. I mean, he was making good movies and was sober before this, but this is his, like, coming out party, as it were. I'm a huge star now, deal with it.
Little kind of references to stuff, like the first scene in the van, well, not the van, the kind of army Humvee, is he's holding the glass of scotch or whatever. It's just like, ooh, are they start layering these little things that could go places, but they don't, but they just imply stuff about him. And, like, I mean, again, you mentioned that first scene, he kind of, like, knocks it out of the park completely in that first scene, and you kind of, it takes you a few seconds to figure out what his deal is, and then you realise, oh no, he's the sarcastic, quippy bastard who you just love to be around and all the rest of it, and yeah, it just, oh god, it just completely works. And stuff,
they based him on Howard Hughes, who, I mean, in this country, it's not as big of a name, but in terms of, like, American, like, history, like, it's a very famous public kind of crazy dude, genius inventor, etc. And, like, you know, they move it from New York to out on in California, and it just works. Like, this is just, you can imagine this person being real, aside from the part where he has magical armor that flies up. Well, it's not magical, it's man-made, you know, this suit of armor. They just did so well at casting a guy that one of his defining traits is just being famous.
So I will ask, so obviously, like, we think that Robert Downey Jr. does a spectacular role. I don't think the MCU exists in the form that it exists now if Robert Downey Jr. is not as good in the role as he is. But do you think that Tony Stark goes through a good arc?
He has the world's tiniest little journey. He has, like, the kernel of a character development. Because, I mean, we see at the beginning, yeah, he's a little bit charming in his own way, but he's a little bit of an asshole. Not in, like, a overly destructive way. He's just entirely focused on profit. And then he goes through a very bad, traumatic experience. He sees a guy die. He sees his weapons being used for bad, and he has that public moment of reflection where he talks about his dad and what this company's about, and he just goes, no, done with that. And, like, literally from that moment on, he's the same for the rest of the film, really. His relationship with Pepper doesn't really change all that much. I mean, you kind of... I don't know. I mean, it seems like the idea of them having a romance might be new, but maybe it isn't. It seems like there's always been the chemistry, etc. You know, he has this moment where he sort of sees his weapons being used, and then he just sort of stares vacantly into the distance and starts tinkering with his suit.
The thing I found interesting last night is watching it, obviously, with the historical context of, like, where we were at in 2008 in terms of the war on terror and stuff like that. It's very interesting that he flies out there after he gets the news that, like, the town that his co-prisoner was from has been bombed, and then basically goes and kills a couple of terrorists and then goes home. And it's like, that's all there is to do with that kind of thing. Like, he doesn't start a war on terrorism or anything like that. He doesn't do anything like actually structured to kind of like stop the systemic terrorism that's going on in the Middle East.
Yes.
Which is probably for the best in terms of being a movie that isn't going to get controversial, but it's still weird that basically it's more of a revenge mission as opposed to him wanting to stop his weapons getting into the wrong hands.
It's not that he's suddenly become a superhero, and like that idea doesn't really occur to him until the end in a very, very, very iconic scene. It's just he's Tony, and he's doing this, and this is what he will do now, and then that's it. And we won't see him become, like, truly proactive until we get to the Avengers. But for now, he is still very sort of self-absorbed. Like, the suit is his little private tinkering thing. It's not really clear why he's doing it at the time, because when he starts making it, you know, there's no weapons to go destroy. There's no reason. I think he's just doing it because he enjoyed making it, and he's like, oh, I could make this better. Like,
but it's also like, I mean, what he spends, is it 2 weeks, 3 weeks they mention, or
and I believe he approaches Rhodey and gets turned away, so I took that to mean he was gonna potentially have Rhodey be the pilot and give it to the military. I don't know, I can see that
it's just one of those weird things where it's like, it's obvious they want to touch on contemporary politics at the time,
yes,
but then they also don't want to get too entrenched in it because obviously it was still ongoing, the movie becomes serious if you basically say we're going to make terrorists the bad guys in our fun, light-hearted kind of.
But he's not off to fight terrorism. He's off to fight these specific dudes who did this thing that involves him.
But then you look at like the amount of weapons they got stockpiled and stuff like that, and you kind of have to take a step back and go, like, this has to be a bigger network than this this one village or this town or whatever that the British reporter is reporting on. I mean, but that's getting into, like, the original plan for the movie was to have the Mandarin, Tony's archenemy in the comics, be the big villain. And I think they realised the complications that would come from actually wholesale adapting the Mandarin.
Yeah, it's a difficult character.
So basically, let's make it the white businessman rather than the...
Well, we will get to him, but we have people to get to first. I mentioned the romance with Pepper Potts. They got an enormous get, I think, in getting Gwyneth Paltrow to sign on to do this movie as Pepper Potts, Tony Stark's longtime sort of assistant, who kind of, as we will learn later, basically runs the company for him. But hey, well, I guess maybe Stane ran it more at this point, but I guess in between Iron Man 1 and 2. Yeah, she said that her brother was a huge Spider-Man fan, and she grew up around Marvel Comics, and she heard who was in it and who was making it. She didn't read a script because there wasn't a script. I guess there was like an outline, but...
I've also heard that apparently she signed on also because the studio was about 15 minutes down the road, so she didn't have to travel and be away from her children.
I mean, I think these are underrated factors that people never consider as fans of movies, but like, you know, if you've got a family and a house and you don't want to travel, like, fucking you do you, girlfriend.
And also a husband at the time who was presumably touring with his massively popular band.
Never heard of them. So, yes, I think she is absolutely excellent and sort of almost in some ways better than the MCU deserves. Like,
yeah, she's really good, and I think she's got so much chemistry with Robert Downey Jr.
It's disgusting how much chemistry they have.
But I will say, I think she's completely short-served in this.
Oh, she is, but I feel this was entirely a let's do damage control on what Iron Man is and nothing more. Like, you mentioned, like, Tony's journey. Like, no one really has a journey. There's not really a huge theme in this movie. There's nothing that's, like, you know, meaty. It's just this is what Iron Man is. And while she doesn't have a huge amount to do, those scenes with Tony are incredibly charming. as they sort of talk over each other, improving their way to greatness. Just all very realistic. The one scene I would... Well, there's a couple. Them sort of awkwardly dancing together as one. But I really like the scene where she's changing his arc reactor and, like, you know... Oh, and yes. Don't pull that up. You did it. Okay, well, I'm just going into cardiac arrest.
I mean, but, like, then I think back to, like, her showcase scene is the one with her and Stane in the business office or whatever it is. And it's just kind of like, oh, look, this is the scene we did to kind of make sure that Gwyneth Paltrow actually earns her paycheck.
Yes.
It's like, oh, look, here's her solo scene where the two supporting actors get to have some fun. That literally, like, I think it's like the only scene in the movie that does not involve Tony in any way whatsoever.
Well, they're on his computer in his office.
True, but like, it's not like when Rhodey's in the room talking to the other soldiers and like he's talking on the phone to Tony and they're talking about Tony. Like,
indeed. Yeah, I think she's great. I think it's great they got her. I think she probably had fun making it, and she will do better things going forward, and then maybe do nothing ever again. Who knows? Well, she's an Avenger.
I will say I did quite enjoy, like, I just, one of those little favorite moments that I forgot they did was that kind of, like, so there's the scene where they have their dance and they go outside and they almost kiss, and then Tony goes back inside to get drinks.
Yes.
And then the plot gets in the way.
Yes.
And then because the plot happens, you kind of forget that, like, they're on this date. Yeah. But then Pepper brings it up later on in the movie, and you kind of go like, oh, shit, she, like, I forgot myself that was still thing going on. And so then making me go like, oh, crap, no, she was still inside waiting for Tony to come back with her drink, but instead he was finding out that his business partner was evil. And
It's one of those. It's a workplace romance where they both openly like each other and the audience wants it to happen, and they pull it off well, I think, and... They have her, and they will have her in the future, but, you know, she's there. Terrence Howard, mathematician extraordinaire, as James Rhodes, who will later be War Machine, or will Terrence Howard be War Machine? Jon Favreau openly said he looked to cast this role so that he could be War Machine in the future. He does the cute little next time thing when he looks at one of the suits.
I think, like, that's the, of all the references in this movie, like the little nods, that is the most explicit... And the most kind of, like, cock-teasy one that they do.
Yes.
In any movie. Like, this isn't this isn't Samuel Jackson showing up and saying, the Avengers is something we want to do. This is them saying, here's the War Machine outfit. We'll do this in the sequel.
He literally says next time. And they did mean it at the time. It's just it wouldn't be him. It's weird seeing Terrence Howard as Rhodey now that we've had Don Cheadle like 4 times.
Well, Iron Man 1, Iron Man 2, Age of Ultron, and
he's in Civil War.
Yes, yeah, Civil War. So 4.
Yeah, we've had 4 Don Cheadles. I maintain that like Don Cheadle just looks like someone's dad and does not come off as like a military person whatsoever. Regardless of the chemistry he may have with RDJ, I think Terrence Howard was better suited physically for this. But it's very strange seeing him now, because I haven't watched Iron Man all the way through in a long time. Like, it's constantly on television, and I catch 10 minutes of it here and there. But
it's interesting, because this is the one of the two big recastings.
Yes.
There are a couple of the smaller ones in like later movies and stuff like that, but like this and one of the next movies we discuss have the two biggest ones in the entire franchise, which basically like show how early on in development and how kind of like they were still figuring stuff out and all the rest of it.
We'll talk about why he isn't in the next one in when we talk about Iron Man 2, but let's talk about what he does do here. It's like fine. I don't think he's knocking it out of the park. I don't think he's stinking up the joint. Like, he has some funny little moments with Stark. I think my favourite moment in the whole film with him is Tony's in the suit and some jets almost shoot him down, and he's like, oh, I'll just say it's his training exercise. And he goes, it's not that simple. And then it smash cuts to training exercise went wrong. Yeah. Like, that's his
big but then I think like, there's the scene on the plane where Tony's just like, oh, we'll have some sake and we'll drink and stuff like that. But again, like, it's more of an editing thing as opposed to, I don't think, like, his drunk acting is particularly...
No, it's...
Like, spectacular. Like, yeah, like, it's just kind of like, they do it and it's like, ha, it's a funny joke because they've done it and the way it's edited, but it's not funny because of the performance that Terrence Howard's giving. Again, like, the cheeky next time comes off as being a little bit forced coming out of him. Like, I can imagine another actor giving that and being like, it's a good, like, fuck yeah moment, I want to see War Machine, because War Machine does have the, like, badass costume, but it still feels a little bit, like, just hokey and forced with how we're doing it. And again, there's so little for anyone to do in this movie that what you have to do is you have to coast on your charisma and your chemistry of everyone else. And it feels like Terrence Howard has the least charisma and chemistry with the rest of the cast. Like, I want to see Tony and Pepper talk. I want to see Tony and Obadiah talk. I'm fine watching Rhodey talk to Tony, but
I feel like every single one of his scenes you're waiting for it to go somewhere it doesn't. Almost like you're waiting for the big Rhodey scene and it doesn't really show up. He's just there to smile and be the friend and tease you. Yeah, he's there. I'm shocked he made more money than Robert Downey Jr. But
I think it's because he just lost the Oscar win.
Yeah.
Or the Oscar nomination. Like, I forget if he actually...
Whereas IDG was fresh off the prison stint. That's not true. It was like 10 years earlier. Next up, I'm going to change up the format that I ran by then at the start. And we're going to talk about Sean Taub as Yinsen. And more generally, we're going to talk about that cave scene at the beginning because they go hand in hand. You know, the Yinsen role, it's a nice little one. It's not like tremendously memorable, but it is tied up in that cave scene, which to me is very memorable because I don't know, had they changed it in the comics to make his origin the Middle East versus Vietnam, or was that
they kept updating it depending, okay, like there's the elastic Marvel universe kind
of problem.
So basically I think they kept updating it every so often, so it has become the Gulf War at some point. I can't pinpoint exactly when it became the Gulf War or when it just became the kind of Middle East in generic, but it has been updated to that time period.
Sure. Okay, well, you know, you start the film with him being charming. He's immediately attacked by terrorists. Ooh, intrigue. You flash back to him being fabulously wealthy, bit of a prick, and then you come back to this cave, and you immediately make this kind of asshole-y character way more sympathetic because, I mean, he's been captured by terrorists and he's been kept in a cave, forced to build weapons, and instead he is just a genius, and he, from scraps, builds the art reactor and the suit and a makeshift bomb for the door and all these different things. And it's very, very effective. And I like the little nod to the original suit that he builds there.
Yeah, I mean, I think of the MCU origin movies, scenes, whatnot, this is the best origin story.
Yes.
With all of them. I don't think it's the best origin movie that Marvel have done. I think there is one other better one. But I think in terms of, like, if you're just going for, like, how the character became the superhero, I think this cave scene and telling that story is the best version of that they've done so far.
So that cave scene, so good. Sean Taub will be back. But, you know, he is in theory the guy that sort of... He doesn't really teach Tony how to be a human because... You know, Tony might be selfish, but he's not like a monster or anything. It's just, you know, he humbles him a bit, and
I think he just
has this little impact on him.
Yeah, he opens his eyes to it. Like, there are other people in this world away from your kind of your world and whatnot. Even if it is just this one man telling stories of his life. Yeah. I will say, I do prefer this role when it's played by Stanley Tucci in another movie.
Yes.
We'll get into the differences and similarities between this movie and Captain America when we actually talk about Captain America. Mm. But when you watch them kind of close together, you realise how overwhelmingly similar they are in terms of structure.
Okay, we have Paul Bettany doing the voiceover for Jarvis and enlightened me that this was recorded in 2 hours as a favour to Jon Favreau. And as you pointed out, he has now been a character in... so many huge movies as Vision, but
spoilers. I mean, he's got two movies as Jarvis still, or three movies as Jarvis still to go, and then he's obviously got Age of Ultron and Civil War and Infinity War coming up, and based on the trailer he's got a decent amount to do in Infinity War.
Yes, and then maybe nothing ever again, we'll see when we get there. I just think Jarvis is brilliant. Like, obviously, like, I don't know, it's hard, like, you cast your mind back to this point. And it's not that the concept of an intelligent computer that talks back is, like, completely foreign or anything, but it's just something about the way they do it, the writing, like, the conversation between Stark and Jarvis that is so cool. And now we have a world of Alexa and Hey Google and Siri and all this nonsense, but
I think
Jarvis is my AI.
it also goes back to how impressive it is, because there's so much of this movie which is just Robert Downey Jr. talking to inanimate objects.
Yeah.
Like, there are long scenes where it's just Robert Downey Jr. talking to his, like, robot helper buddies.
Yes.
And you have to, like, I don't know whether or not Paul Bettany was, like, piped in or whether or not someone is doing it, but, like, that has to be some of the hardest stuff you can do as an actor, is basically you have to be charismatic to something that is not there and you do not know what you're playing off of.
Yeah, especially, like, modern films. Like, how many films are not made with green screen these days? And, like, it's crazy, like, what these actors do. And, like, RDJ, as you said, at times he's giving a solo performance, and it's great. And I wanted to talk about Jarvis because my favourite thing about... because, you know, he's not... A lot of people didn't even know it's Paul Bettany. Like, he's a relatively... You don't even think of him as a character, I'm sure, some people. But my favourite part of this movie is him building the Mark II costume in his basement after getting back from the war. From Afghanistan. Just seeing him piece by piece put this suit together, improve it, fuck around, tinker, like, try and fly, and he smashes into a wall, flying over his car and then landing and saying, yep, I can fly. Just everything, and, like, you know, colouring it up and having it made, and by far my favourite part of this film. And just Jarvis is such a huge part of that for me.
I mean, it's such a good movie that the kind of, again, it just comes down to the fact, like, there's so little to this movie that they make the stuff, the kind of lack of stuff, enjoyable. Into, like, there's not much going on, but everything that's going on is enjoyable to watch, and you're just having fun watching them do it. And I mean, it's a really impressive feat that basically when you think about this movie hard, you kind of have to strain to think, like, kind of, did anything actually happen? Then you just kind of go back to, like, that line that he said, or that kind of just piece of physical comedy, like the bit where he says, I'm going to use 10% of the thrusters, and then he just smashes into the wall behind him.
Yes.
Such a hard thing to make something feel so laid back.
Yes, I think that's a good way of putting it, that, like, it all seems very comfortable and casual, but they're doing such impressive things.
Yeah.
I guess, well, Clark Gregg makes his debut as Agent Coulson, an MCU original character. This is all put in here to tease the future of the MCU. He represents S.H.I.E.L.D. A little bit of a shaky performance from him here in his first outing as Coulson. I'm not tremendously familiar with Clark Gregg's career outside of Marvel. I've seen him in stuff here and there after this, but I wasn't really aware of him before this.
I mean, apparently he was only supposed to be in one scene, which I assume is the first scene that he was in, where he talks to Pepper and asks to schedule an interview, and he mentions the Dreadic Homeland, like, the amount of times he says that throughout the movie. But I assume it's that one, because it's the one where, like, he looks kind of awkward in the suit. You just kind of look at him, and you just kind of go, like, oh, you don't... He doesn't seem like a...
Suit wearer.
No, he doesn't. And, like, I think he grows into it later on. I don't know whether it's just because they got, like, an ill-fitting suit for that first scene, but, like, later on in the movie, he's got more confidence, and he's definitely better kind of interacting with the characters. But, like, when he first showed up, I was just like, oh, God, is Clark Gregg having an off day? Because...
I forgot. This is rough.
Yeah, and, like, the character must be second nature to him at this point, considering he's got as many movies as he has and 5 seasons of a TV show.
Go that, dude.
Yeah, I mean, to go from having, you're going to be in one scene where basically all you're going to do is say this long phrase and then wink at the audience who know what it is, to being the emotional linchpin of the biggest movie, the third biggest movie of all time.
The Claire Temple of the MCU film division. So, Leslie Bibb, as Christine Everhart, is in this film. John Favreau, the director, plays Happy Hogan, who's Tony's sort of chauffeur.
Is he in this movie?
He's in it, technically. He points out that the aforementioned Leslie Bibb is hot, and then he gets out of Jeff Bridges' way at one point.
Like, it's amazing, because, like, he has so much more to do in 2, 3 and Spider-Man Homecoming.
I was shocked at how little he's in this.
Like, it's just like, I mean, obviously you have to think that, like, this is probably, I mean, because he's directed and acted in stuff before.
Yeah, Pete Becker, Friends, is what I knew him at. When I learned he was, like, a director, I was like, wait, what?
But, like, I mean, like, I'm fairly sure he's got a decent role in Elf.
It's not decent, but he's in it.
Yeah, but like this is not like he's gone, I'm going to play this role and this is going to be my first time directing and acting at the same time.
Oh, okay, yeah, I see what you're saying, yeah.
Like he has, it's not like he was basically going like, oh, I don't want to give myself too much to do just in case I can't direct the scene at the same time.
Yeah, but there was probably a script for Elf, so.
I mean, sure, but the amount that he was bumped up, because it's not like they probably went into Iron Man 2 and then said, oh, we have to make Happy a bigger role because people loved him in Iron Man. It was just he got a bigger role because I don't know, like that. I mean, that movie's bloated to begin with, but yes. We'll get into that. But yeah, it's weird to see. I mean, because he does such a good job at directing this movie and making the tone and making everything fit together that him showing up is almost distracting in this one.
A little bit, yeah. Oh, and Stan Lee in his first, he did cameos in the X-Men films, right?
Oh yeah, he's Spider-Man, he's in Fantastic Four, he's in X-Men. So this is not the first cameo, but this is the first MCU cameo.
Yeah, and I feel they became like a thing in the MCU.
They became a thing. He started showing up in movies for characters he didn't create, which is where I draw the line of being like some level of BS.
Hey,
where it's just
that man like did so much. He can be in what he wants. So a big thing with Marvel movies, for as much as they're praised, and just superhero movies generally, there is a large criticism of movies, and a regular feature of this podcast miniseries is going to be called Villain Watch. And we're just going to keep track of how good or bad the villains are as we go. And our villain this time around is Jeff Bridges as Obadiah Stane, aka Ironmonger. Technically, of Raza, who was the leader of the Ten Rings. And when I watched it, I assumed he was going to become Mandarin, and I think that may have even potentially been a plan at one point, but the main villain here is Obadiah Stane. Jeff Bridges is quite a charismatic actor with a lot of presence, which is shocking news. He has shockingly little to really do. Like, he has a few scenes he can like chew up a bit and ham up in terms of, I am an evil villain. But a lot of it's just standing next to Tony in a suit and sort of exchanging quips with him. And like, apparently they cut a lot of his scenes. But I think while it's not necessarily like a compelling, it's not like a narratively rich character, because it's Jeff Bridges and because he so incredibly like embodies the look of this character, and it doesn't look like Jeff Bridges has looked before, obviously, I think it really works. Like, for as much as I hate that a lot of Iron Man stories boil down to Iron Man fighting a knockoff Iron Man, I do actually think this is one of the better ones, but it's a pretty good performance, I think. And maybe that's just because, you know, maybe it's the Heller effect, where they just cast a really good actor and that made it good.
I think that's a big part of it, is I think Jeff Bridges could do this in his sleep and just be kind of charismatic and good-looking, and oh my god, the suits are incredible. Like, I just kind of like got distracted every single time he was on screen. Like, the scene where he admits to Tony that he's the one that's selling...
Oh, with his little white scarf thing.
His little white scarf is just like, oh my god, like... Yeah. But yeah, like, Jeff Bridges, he could do this in his sleep, and I think, because the original plan was to have Ironmonger be the villain of Iron Man 2, and I think
slow turn, the Harvey Two-Face. Yeah.
I mean, similar to what they're doing with Doctor Strange, is kind of like, you have someone who's his ally in the first movie, and then you turn them villainous in the second one, and I think I would prefer that, because I just think, like, of all the characters, like, I, as much as Gwyneth Paltrow doesn't get an arc, as much as Rhodey doesn't get anything to do, really, as much as you've said, like, Robert Downey Jr. has the world's tiniest journey, I would just like to see more of Obadiah and Tony be friends, because I think that's where I enjoyed it, and, like, as much fun as it is to see Jeff Bridges pulling out little earplugs and making people go paralyzed with some of the worst makeup that I've seen in a movie recently.
Yeah.
Like, it's still fun, but I just would like to see a bit more of him being charismatic and chummy with Tony.
I will say, I think of the people that don't have a lot to do, he suffers the least from, I mean, probably Tony, but he suffers a lot less from it than Pepper and Rhodey do, because he's still just being Jeff Bridges, and it's still sort of a semi-memorable character, in a way.
I'm just sad that the turn kind of comes as suddenly as it does.
Yeah.
Like, I like the aftermath, as I mentioned earlier, like, the scene where basically Tony is so blindsided by it, he ignores Pepper, and I think that works very well for the character. But it still literally comes after a scene where they've been chummy and having pizza together, and all these little things. And then like the next scene is just like, oh, okay, we need Jeff Bridges to be the villain now. Who's the villain now? Yeah. And it's like, oh, okay, all right, fine. We're
also, I've got to ask, why does he make the suit? Like, isn't his whole deal he wants to make more money and make the company more profitable and all this? Like, every single suit would be so expensive and each one would require an arc reactor, which is, again, expensive. Like, he's surely not planning to mass produce these things. Like, is he literally building it to build it?
I think the aim is to basically, he wants, they give him the, they obviously like the Ten Rings dig up the suit. He takes the suit, makes it bigger.
Yes, much bigger.
Much bigger. And then steals Tony's arc reactor because they can't make it smaller.
Mm.
And then I imagine his plan is to both mass produce the arc reactors and then sell iron suits to the military on both sides of the war at that time. Is what I imagine his plan is, and he just double deals, and then, I mean, because you see in the movies going forward where everyone wants the Iron Man tech,
yes.
And everyone's trying to make their own version of the Iron Man tech. It's just that thing where it's just like, ooh, you can have a super soldier who can do all these things, and you put a good shoulder in them, and they'll be really, really strong and powerful.
I don't know, I just feel it's like maybe missing a line of dialogue somewhere. It just seems a bit generic super villainy. I will make a giant monster suit.
Again, that's so much of what my issues with it is that it comes down to generic villainy. Because he seems actively excited about making the arc reactor.
Yeah.
And as they show in, again, future movies, that the arc reactor is this great piece of tech that starts to revolutionize all these different things. Like, it's a plot point in 2, it's a plot point in the Avengers. And you think you'd be able to make money, from just making that, but then his idea is like, no, we will also make this and also kill people.
Hmm. Still, his line reading of Tony Stark built this in a cave with scraps is legendary to me. Right, but for years I've said, because people, like, so many people love Iron Man, and a lot of, like, casuals who don't go and see every Marvel film are like, Iron Man was really good, but I don't know about some of these other ones. I always counter with the first, like, half to two-thirds of it are great, but there's no, like, heart to it, there's no themes, there's no journeys, and also that back end kind of sucks a bit, and we will be playing the game of good third act, bad third act, wherein a lot of Marvel movies do this, where they start really strong and then just the end becomes nonsense. This is not a good third act of a movie. I think there are worse ones in the MCU.
Yes, there are definitely, like, again, like, I don't think anything this movie does, I think Jeff Bridges is probably the best big bad of all three Iron Man movies.
Low bar.
Yeah, it is a low bar, but I think he's the best of the three. It might just about be the best third act of the Iron Man movies.
Or I might
be completely, like, lying up my ass there, and 2 is actually got a surprisingly decent.
No, we haven't watched it yet, but I'm going to tell you no on that one. What's this versus, like, a million Iron Man suits and the president hanging from a thing and Gwyneth Paltrow having... Oh, I can't wait to do Iron Man 3. All right, this is the most solid. It's the least bad of the three Iron Man third acts.
But my issue with it is that it comes down to the fact that I've now watched 17 of these movies, because we're recording this before Black Panther's been released.
Yes.
There are better ones, and so I think worse of this one.
True.
Like, it's like when I saw it in the cinema, I was like, oh, cool, that was fun. Like, it was just kind of like, not disposable, because I obviously still thought really highly of it. But then when I think about the superhero movie that came out a couple of months after this one, I definitely wasn't thinking about Iron Man as being the best superhero movie of 2008 by the end of the year.
Yeah, a little film came out.
Tiny one. Nothing to write home about.
If you listen to the Tape Crusaders on EnterTheRealWorld.com, you can listen to our thoughts about it. Yeah, I just think they did the simplest thing possible in every sense with this, and it was the most paint-by-numbers ending. Like, oh, the bad guy gets his version of the suit, and they have to do a thing that blows it up. I don't know. It's not much of a fight. It's the back end isn't... It's just not as good. A bad third act, but not the worst one.
No, it's if we were doing a ranking, it would be profoundly, like, in the middle.
Yes, it's aggressively mediocre, this film, in terms of the MCU generally. It did what it did. It laid a foundation for everything that's going to come afterwards. They had a lot of work to do to rehabilitate a whole character, and...
I don't even say rehabilitate, I think it just had to...
Introduce. Yeah, so they had a lot to do there, and... look, this film in a vacuum is not as good as other entries of the MCU. I put it in the middle to potentially just below the middle of the pack. A lot of people put it right near the top. Some people say it's the best one. Those people are high off their asses.
I've got it like high middle is where I've got it in my personal rank.
I don't
like
have the ranking to hand. I think you do, but we're going to maybe do one as a site. Like me, Mike, and Ben will vote, aggregate it, and post it as a thing on the week leading up to Infinity War. So we'll get to that. But
Mike's going to ruin the rankings.
He is, because he thinks that Iron Man 3 is bad, and he's wrong.
He thinks Iron Man 2 is the best Iron Man film.
I know, and he's wrong. Anyway, just a couple of little bits before we get out of here. One thing that I completely forgot to think about when making all my notes for this, just the look of the suit and the effects generally. Pretty good. Like, obviously, it's going to get better, and you know, special effects improve all the time, but I was not surprised, but like, for a film that cost $140 million and how much of that went to the cast and like, you know, some of the filming locations and whatnot, pretty good looking film, pretty good suit. Like, it's not like so incredibly obviously CG that it takes you out of it.
I think the big issue is that it does set a visual template that's aggressively almost kind of pedestrian.
Mm.
Like, it doesn't do anything spectacular. And I think only recently are we seeing movies that actually try to do something different with the visuals.
Sure.
But, like, this movie basically goes, we don't want auteurs. We don't want people with interesting visual ideas. We want people who can make the movie we want them to make. And I think Jon Favreau, like, you look at the people who they've hired after this one, and they're all either low-budget directors coming into their first big-budget movie, or they're TV directors. And I mean, if you work in TV, then you know that like you have lower budgets, less time to do stuff. So basically, a lot of stuff you're doing is basically, we need to get this shot and we need to move on.
Yeah.
And there's no fancy camera angles and stuff like that. And I mean, I think there is good visual stuff in the MCU, but as much as you can like shit all over the DC expanded universe, like, Zack Snyder is an auteur, and
he's an infinitely superior like visual filmmaker to anyone that Marvel have, but he has his own issues.
But that's kind of, again, like, if we're touching on like the kind of the weaknesses of the Marvel movies, is the villains aren't always that great, the third acts aren't always that great, and visually they're not. The stuff that's going on the screen is exciting, but how they're showing you the stuff that's going on the screen isn't the most exciting.
I understand what you're saying. You're waiting for Scott Derrickson to turn up and fix everything. I mean, I think we've touched on almost everything for me. Like, Jon Favreau very much laid out the template for pretty much every Marvel film for a long time, where you have your little origin bit, and you have your Easter eggs, and you have your post-credit scene. I will say the decision to have it end with him saying, "I am Iron Man," I think was huge.
I mean, again, when you look at the movies that have come up before now, on both sides, from DC and Marvel, so much of them are about secret identities. Like, Spider-Man's all about keeping a secret identity. X-Men's all about being cordoned off from the rest of the world. Superman, Batman, they're very much about the dichotomy between the man and the superhero.
Yeah. And then, the Fantastic Four in the comics are famously, like, public with who they are, but that's a bit different. I don't know if this was done in the comics before with Iron Man, but it certainly was different for a film.
I don't think it was like Iron Man's one of those ones where it's like Iron Man is Tony Stark's bodyguard.
Yes, I know they did that for a long time, but
that's the historic thing. I don't think they ever did it in as big a way as like there was no Spider-Man unmasking himself during Civil War.
Kind of
level thing for Tony Stark. So this, I think this was mostly an idea from Kevin Feige, probably. Because it's like, what can we do that's different to other superhero movies?
Yes.
Well, why don't we make our hero public?
Yeah, it's huge. It gives him such a different feel to every other comic book character out there, wherein he is this public guy who revels in being Iron Man. And it's a strength, I think, of the second and third film, which, you know, have their problems, as we'll talk about, but just that decision here to have him go, "I am Iron Man." And you get the idea he wasn't going to do it until, you know, he's taking the questions and he's talking about heroism and everything. And I think, you know, he's like, "No, yeah, I like this idea. I like this idea of what I'm doing. I will be a superhero. I am Iron Man." And just this, you know, it speaks to how rich he is, how powerful he is, how brilliant he is, that he can just, he has the means to decide to do this, and he does it. It's like an inverse Batman, where like Batman sort of, his life's mission is to be Batman. It's all about that. This is just a guy who kind of decides, I will be this. And it's a theme that will come up again and again. You want to talk about the music, I think?
I mean, it's one of those things, like, the most interesting thing and stuff about the music in this movie is the fact that they got AC/DC, which I feel...
Yeah, it goes hand in hand. So like,
It does, but I feel like they hamstrung themselves with basically, like, this is... They made the buying of, kind of, like, other music too integral to the score, and then they basically went to Ramin Djawadi. God, I probably butchered that entirely. The guy who does the music for Game of Thrones.
Ah.
And basically told him to do like a metal soundtrack kind of thing.
Yeah.
And
he was like, I've got this thing. Da, 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 da. And they're like, we hate it.
But yeah, like, it's just, it's so like, because obviously like when you think of the movie, you don't think of the actual score at all. You think of
Back and Thrill and Back and Black.
Yeah. Yeah, you think of all those songs. And so when you think of like the other superheroes, you like Superman, Batman have like these iconic themes, like the Spider-Man theme's really good. And then you get to this movie and it's just like they set nothing up. Like, I'm trying to imagine a world in which Avengers happens and all the heroes have their like individual little orchestral music stickers, and like when they show up they kind of like do that and then they combine into that Avengers theme song. And like the Avengers theme is the only theme that we have at this point, and I got chills when I heard it in the Infinity War trailer.
100%, yeah. Like, say what you want about Batman v Superman, that Wonder Woman theme that kicks in at the end did them wonders, and when you hear it again in Wonder Woman, it's great stuff.
Like, there is one superhero theme that I do enjoy from these movies, and we will talk about that one in this movie.
Okay.
But I'm not going to spoil it now.
Oh, interesting.
To be honest, like, there's a lot that I want to talk about in a particular movie that is just basically going to be gushing about how good this movie is and how everyone hates it.
Ah, I'm very intrigued. It's
not Iron Man 3.
It's not Iron Man 3. Okay. All right, so one last thing to talk about. I mentioned it earlier. I mentioned it in sort of Favreau trying to build out this universe with Easter eggs and whatnot. In the post-credits scene, you have Samuel L. Jackson, pretty big star, 9-picture deal, unheard of at the time, and it's Nick Fury. And he goes, you're not the only suit. The dialogue is not great, but I think Brian Michael Bendis wrote it. But
he wrote 3 pages of dialogue, and they basically just cherry-picked certain lines that they wanted to use.
He's like, you think you're the only superhero, I want to talk to you about the Avengers, or something along those lines.
Yeah. The weird thing I felt watching the scene yesterday was, like, oh, you think you're the world's first superhero, you're entering a world of whatever, and then you kind of like, you watch all the other movies and you go like, no, Iron Man's pretty much the first superhero.
Yeah,
like who are you referring to? Captain America has not been found yet. If you're talking about Hawkeye and Black Widow, then
he's talking about the Fantastic Four, because Marvel are getting them back and they're going to arrive back on Earth after being away for several years.
You might have to edit that out, Matt. If the Fox deal falls through in the next week.
Oh shit! Yeah, at the time of this recording, like, we don't know if that happens or not. Shit, I will decide on that by January. I don't know. Like, this scene, I can't. I saw Iron Man for the first time, like, when this was all already well in play. Like, I think Thor had even come out when I saw
Iron Man. Wait, you hadn't seen Iron Man by that point?
No.
What?
I saw, like, Thor, like, the day after I saw the Avengers. I think Incredible Hulk, I was aware. I knew, like, Iron Man was a thing. And, like, you know, it was out there and people were like, oh, yeah, Iron Man's really good. And I was aware of Incredible Hulk and all that. And then I saw Iron Man. I was like, oh, okay. And like, it was already a plan. So I can't imagine seeing Iron Man for the first time and losing my shit when it's like, oh my god, the new stuff.
I freaked the fuck out when it happened. I mean, there'd been rumours that there was something. Basically, like, at this point in the internet, it was basically people going like, ah, stay past the credits. You know, like, ooh, what's it going to be? And me, as the little comic book nerdy guy that I am, like, I'd read at this point Mark Miller's and Brian Hitch's Ultimates. And in that, like, the only reason they cast Samuel L. Jackson was because Brian Hitch drew the Ultimate version of Nick Fury as Samuel L. Jackson, and so basically they just went to Samuel L. Jackson and said, like, hey, this one version of this character looks like you, do you want to be in a 9-movie contract?
And he's like, yeah, because Samuel L. Jackson, as we historically know, does not know how to turn down a movie role.
But yeah, like, I'm just watching this scene and, like, it's weird because you think there's not much cultural presence of the Avengers.
No.
like, you know what the Avengers are if you know comic books. You know that they are the superhero team that Marvel has in comparison to Justice League.
Yeah, but exactly. It's that. Like, it's that they're Marvel's Justice League, but nowadays you sort of do the opposite, where people are like, oh, what's the Justice League? It's like, oh, it's like the Avengers, but DC.
Yeah, but it's still weird to think that kind of, like, there wasn't an Avengers cartoon in the 90s.
No.
There was Spider-Man, there was X-Men, there was a Hulk cartoon, there was an Iron Man cartoon, but, like, there wasn't this super team cartoon, and yet somehow my little early comic book fan brain was able to tell that this was a big deal.
Yeah, it's crazy, because, like, I don't know, I think there's a reason that they put it at the end of the credits in some ways, because that's for, like, big fans, in a way. Because I don't think that name carried any weight, and I don't think people... He doesn't say his name as Nick Fury, but I don't think that carried any weight to the mainstream. So it's their... I think it's a statement of intent that, like, yeah, we're making films that we want to be blockbusters, but we are also concerned with the canon, and these are being made by Marvel, not just some studio that have glanced at a comic book once upon a time. And they're there to give you little winks and nods as a fan, and, like, as my comic book knowledge has increased over time, because when I watched these early movies, I didn't know shit about Marvel. Like, I knew what I knew from cartoons and stuff, like, and video games. Like, I hadn't really read many Marvel comics, and as it's increased over time and I see these little winks and nods, I get such a kick out of it. And I can imagine that it was that times a million when you see Nick Fury show up at the end.
Like, yeah, I mean, like, that, I think that was the biggest moment. Like, I enjoyed the War Machine reference. I enjoyed, like, the little tiny nods, like, as I mentioned, like, the little glass of scotch in Tony's hand at the start of the movie. Like, I enjoyed a lot of these things, but it's the Nick Fury one that you just kind of go, like, this is real.
Yeah.
Like, this is something bigger. They are promising so much at this point. And I think it's a lot more successful than probably the next couple of this kind of post-credit scenes. Like, definitely the next one. The next one will require even more discussion about...
The next one barely makes sense.
The post-credit scene that takes them 8 years to pay off.
Yeah. Anyway, it was a crazy thing they were trying. Like, if you say it in a vacuum, oh yeah, we're going to make, like, five movies that lead to one movie. Like, that's a lot of risk. That's like James Cameron saying, I'm making five Avatar movies. Like,
I'm filming four of them back to back.
Yeah, that's like Warner Bros. Saying, we're going to make five Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them movie. Like, it's crazy, but it worked. And I mean, we've seen DC try it, and it doesn't work when you outright state it and you don't finesse it right. So
Marvel did this the right way.
They did.
In that they hid this scene at the end of the credits, and if this movie bombed, they could just ignore it and they could move on and do what they wanted to do next with whatever.
Yeah.
And I don't even think that the cameo at the end of the next movie was filmed until after this movie had been a success.
No, I doubt it.
I think that was literally the last thing that was shot for the next movie in the series, and the only reason it's there is because Iron Man 1 was such a massive success, or like such a surprise success. It made the amount of money that it made, and no one was expecting it to make that much money.
I remember people talking about it. It made a lot of money. So important. It laid that foundation. You know, it's very bare bones, and I'm surprised we got this much conversation out of it, but we did. And it can't be understated how important it was as a starting point. They will make better, and they will make worse. But for this first episode on Iron Man, I think that is gonna do it. So the next audio you hear will be concerning The Incredible Hulk with Ed Norton, you know, who's a huge part of the MCU, as you all know from the 17 films that have come. So yeah, we'll be talking about that, and that'll be fun. I think this has been good. This has been Ben and Matt's Marvelous Journey. Thank you for listening. Bye, Ben.
Bye.